Hello and welcome. My name is Rick Gibson. I'm the Associate Vice President for Public Affairs here at Pepperdine University, and I'd like to welcome you to this edition of Pepperdine People Online. Today I'm joined by Dr. Paul Contino, who is the Professor of Great Books, and he recently sat down with Robert Louis Wilkin as Dr. Wilkin came to Pepperdine and offered a lecture to our students. Welcome, Paul. We're glad you're here today.
Thanks, Rick. Good to be here.
Tell us a little bit about Dr. Wilkin and about his visit here at Pepperdine.
I had heard of Dr. Wilkin from his work, and I thought it would be wonderful if the faculty got a seminar together and read his most recent work, The Spirit of Early Christian Thought, in which he talks about some of the earliest Christian thinkers like Augustine and Maximus and others, and what those thinkers might have to teach us about something we talk a lot about here at Pepperdine, that is the relationship between faith and learning, faith and reason, the place of prayer in our intellectual lives. And we had a wonderful series of conversations with him in a small group with the faculty, and he gave a wonderful lecture on Augustine's Confessions to our Great Books II students.
And then you had an opportunity to sit down with him and have the interview our listeners are about to hear.
So, that's right.
Right now, we'd like to just invite you to sit back and listen to this interview with Robert Louis Wilkin, the William R. Keenan Professor of History of Christianity at the University of Virginia.
My name is Paul Contino. I teach great books here at Pepperdine. I'm speaking with Robert Louis Wilkin, the author of the wonderful book, The Spirit of Early Christian Thought, Seeking the Face of God, published by Yale University Press. We're very glad you're here at Pepperdine. You have a new book coming out of Erdmann's, A Study of Isaiah, which draws on the work of the Church Fathers. And a group of faculty is currently reading The Spirit of Early Christian Thought here at Pepperdine. And for many of us, it's an introduction to the fathers of the church, and it's just a wonderful way of getting to know some of these figures. And in fact, Robert will be joining me in my Great Books class today at 12 when we'll be reading and talking about St. Augustine's Confessions. Tell us about these fathers. You look at four in particular in the Spirit of Early Christian Thought: Origen, Augustine, Gregory of Nyssa, Maximus, the Confessor. Who are these people? What kinds of personalities did they have? Do you find that they've become individual personalities since over the years you've spent so much time reading them and getting to know them? And what characterizes each of them?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that Christianity has been around a very long time. 2 millennia now, 2,000 years. And as one looks over the history of the church, as is the case with almost anything that's historically important, the early centuries are the formative, the foundational period. And one of the things that's characteristic of Christianity is that it begins as a movement among the Jewish people in response to the life and the preaching of Jesus, and then in particular to his resurrection. And so it begins with a firm conviction about who Jesus is, what it is that is most important in life. Mm-hmm. But as the decades go by, people find that they need to have the language, the concepts, the ideas to express, to give some verbal and intellectual form to the things that they believe. And that's really what the Church Fathers did. The Church Fathers is a term that we use. It simply means the church's earliest and most important teachers. We're talking here about roughly the years from around 100, 150 to about 500 or 600. And during that period, Christianity was centered primarily in the Roman Empire. And an extraordinary fact is that the church attracted some of the most gifted men of the time. And they then began to express what they thought was most important about Christianity. And there are four that I single out in particular. One was a man by the name of Origen of Alexandria. He lived from about 200 to about 250. And Origen's great gift was that he was a man with a capacity to understand at the very deepest level what the scriptures were about. So he really became the first commentator on the Bible to write actual biblical commentators. A second was Gregory of Nyssa, who lived in the 4th century. Nyssa is a small, insignificant town, really, in modern-day Turkey, Central Asia Minor. And Gregory was distinguished in the sense that he had a keen philosophical mind, and he was able to understand the problem that he was faced with was, how can it be that if Christians believe that God is one, that Jesus of Nazareth, Jesus Christ, is also God? And so he worked out in great detail with many scriptural texts and many philosophical ideas how to express this mystery that there could be, in fact, a Son of God, and God could still be one.
Yes.
The third that I speak of was Augustine of Hippo, and he was living in what is presently Tunisia. Augustine is probably, of all, the one who is most accessible to us today. He was a bishop in really a provincial town on the coast of the Mediterranean, again in present day. Actually, he was born in Tunisia, but where he actually served was in Algeria, present day Algeria. And Augustine also was a great biblical commentator, but he wrote one of the most important works in defense of Christianity. He wrote a very introspective account of his own conversion to Christianity. Much to everyone's amazement, he wrote it in the form of a prayer to God. So everything that he says, even when he talks about his own life, he writes addressing God in the second person. It allowed him to express the deepest feelings and emotions that he had, because he put them in the form of prayers to God. And one thing is that he really began to explore the interior life, the inner life, that as no one had ever done before. And then finally, a man by the name of Maximus the Confessor, who was actually in the 7th century, right about the time that the Muslims conquered the whole Middle East. And Maximus was a monk. So he lived in a religious community. And Maximus's great achievement was that he had almost a kind of cosmic vision, that the significance of Christ wasn't just to change the hearts and minds of people, but it was a kind of complete renewal of the entirety of the creation. In fact, published a little book of translations in which it talks about the cosmic mystery. Those are only four. There were many, many more. But what it means is that Christianity has a strong foundation of people who thought about what they believed and tried to give expression. In fact, that's when we first begin to get the expression, faith seeking understanding. Yes. It's not enough simply to believe. One has to be able to give reasons and to understand the things that one believes.
You mentioned that Confessions is written in the form of a prayer. And I was wondering, you know, Peter Brown, whom we were talking about earlier, wrote this wonderful biography of Augustine. There's been a recent one written, which from what I've read in the reviews suggests Augustine was not a very pleasant person. Occasionally I'll read biographical sketches of saints that people will be calling into question what they were really like as people. You gave us a wonderful anecdote when you said you ran into Rowan Williams at Oxford. And outside of Blackfriars, you could tell the story better, but you said something about always reading these people with the benefit of the doubt. And Rowan responded, who was, of course, the Archbishop of Canterbury, with the exception of Jerome. He was awfully difficult. My question is,
Jerome was a very unpleasant man, but he was a great scholar, biblical scholar,
yeah.
And he had a revolutionary idea up to his day, which is around the year 400, Christians read the Old Testament, which is, of course, a Jewish book that Christians continued to revere and to consider authoritative. They read it only in a Greek translation, which is called the Septuagint, or translations that were based on the Septuagint. And Jerome realized that the Hebrew original text, which is what, of course, the Jews continue to read to this day, was the primary text. And so he translated the Bible, the whole Old Testament, into Latin for the very first time. That is, first time among Christians. It had not really been translated into Latin by anybody else. And so his achievement and his contribution to Christianity from that time on, Christians had then to take seriously the Hebrew, the Jewish version of the Bible. But he was not an easy man to get along
with. Well, that's what I'm wondering. I love when you say early in the book, in the spirit of early Christian thought, that the theologian is one who prays. Augustine writes his most famous work as a prayer. The goal of life, analogous to Aristotle's goal of what he calls eudaimonia, happiness, is transformed to become happiness in the Christian sense, which is holiness. Was the fact that these people prayed as earnestly as they studied and they translated, was this something that showed up in the accounts of their lives? Were they holy figures? Or was Jerome, who could be cantankerous, the exception? Did the work and the prayer that they engaged in create a kind of holy presence that others recognized?
Well, I think one thing to keep in mind when one is reading thinkers of the sort we're talking about here, people like Augustine of Hippo or Origen of Alexandria, the model that we have of a person who is primarily a thinker or an intellectual is a university professor whose work is significant only for the value of his ideas or her ideas. How the person lives, what he does outside of his books, outside of her books, is really quite secondary. But these people did not think this way. For them, what they did each day in their life was a part of who they were as a thinker. Most of them were bishops. That is, that they were pastors of congregations and of groups of congregations. And they were men who each morning prayed the Psalms. That means reading the Psalms out loud, who at least twice, three, sometimes four times a week would be at the altar celebrating the Eucharist. They were most comfortable with the book of the Bible open before them. Almost everything that they write on the basis of actual citations from the Bible. They believe that they are not teaching their own views. They are explaining and expounding what it is that has been revealed in the Holy Scriptures. So that's one very important factor. They begin with prayer and adoration and worship of God. Now, the question of holiness is a little more complicated and somewhat tricky, because holiness doesn't mean you're a nice guy or a nice girl. It means that you have an intensity of devotion to God, and that can take many different forms, often ones that are disturbing to others because they are so unconventional. One of the things that happened is that people felt that if they were going seriously to give themselves to God, they would have to go and live alone. And so some went out into the desert. Part of that was is that they felt that only if they were alone could they fight all the forces that were working on them, because the forces that cause us to do evil don't come from other people. They come from within. And so they went out in the desert so they could really fight the devil on his own terms.
My understanding, though, is that they developed in this kind of solitary spiritual journey to such an extent that others wanted to be near them, and they would form communities around them. Didn't this happen to Anthony?
Well, that of course, is what happened, is that holiness attracts people. It's infectious, you know. It's like anybody that does anything extraordinary, if you see somebody play the violin well, we almost instinctively want to be like them. I mean, that's basically how we learn to be moral persons. We follow the example of others. We want to be like a person who does good and virtuous deeds. And so they attracted people, and then they formed – there are really two forms of community. One would be where they're actually living by themselves and only come together once in a while, and others where they live actually together. Yes. in a community.
Yes.
But the point I was getting at is that holiness often has very rough edges to it, to the non-holy person. And so they might not always be the kind of person it would be pleasant to sit down and have a conversation with or eat dinner with. It's radical. It's different.
It's radical.
It's other.
But the love is radical, and it's true. I mean, Jesus made people uncomfortable in the scriptures, but, you know, they all have in common, scripturally, John says God is love. St. Paul says the greatest of these is love. At the end of the Confessions, Augustine says the rule of charity, the rule of love is what, you know, finally trumps everything else. Finally, charity has to be at the heart of it, yes?
Well, I can give a good story from these early Christian, in this case, a monk who lived in the desert outside of Jerusalem, the Judean desert, named Eufthymius. And Eufthymius wanted to live alone, and he kept moving. Anytime people would start to come to him, then he'd go further into the desert. He went into the deeper and the farther desert, as he put it. But when he died, he called in his fellow monks, and he talked to them about love. And he said that love was more important than humility. Because with humility, you can often breed pride.
Sure.
That you're more humble than somebody else. And one of the stories that he did not tell, but others were told, it had to do with a young monk comes to visit an older monk, and the older monk then wants to give him something to eat, and he says, oh, no, he says, I don't eat until the end of the day. He says, I don't. He said, but you're visiting me now. Why don't you want to have something to eat? We can have some fun. He says, no, I don't want to eat anything. So he keeps refusing him. And finally, it dawns on him that the most important thing is when you are faced with another person.
Yes.
That your responsibility is to love that
person,
not to try to show them how holy
right,
you are.
Of course.
It's sort of like the person who comes to your house and you serve them a nice dinner, and then you prepare a beautiful dessert, and they say, oh, I can't have that because I'm on a diet. You know?
Well, this brings us
that's
to
love.
And I think in a deeper sense, it's also humility, because it suggests that the particular circumstance that one is in calls one in a way one hadn't expected to attend to the other, in a way that was outside the plan. So this brings us to wisdom, in a sense, practical wisdom, phronesis, prudence. Prudentially, he had to make the decision, this is the time to break bread with this, this guest. And you talk about the way in which the early Christian teachers recuperated and kind of reanimated the cardinal virtues. Could you talk a little bit about that and perhaps how prudence in particular is an important one?
Well, the Greeks, the ancient Greeks, basically tried to find a way to organize how one thinks about living a virtuous, a moral life. And they ordered the virtuous life by saying there are four cardinal virtues. Mm-hmm. Wisdom, or prudence. Justice, which has to do with your relationship to others. Courage. And then temperance. And if you think about that, that's really a nice
covers
kind
the
of
basis. Yeah. Yes.
But wisdom, of course, is or prudence is the primary one, because it requires a degree of reflection, which is not as necessary for the others. And so then what Christians did is that they took these over, because they were as much interested in people living virtuous lives as the ancient Greeks or the Romans were. But they began then to give them a kind of a Christian sheen or a sort of a shine. And what Augustine said is that they all have to be understood as forms of love. And so that wisdom then becomes love, trying to determine the best course of action and taking into consideration justice. Of course, it's easier to see because that means attending to what the needs of the other are or what the needs of society are. And courage, we think of courage primarily as a sort of martial virtue, you know, the courage to go into battle. But actually, it's a very personal and human and in many ways an intellectual virtue, you know, the willingness to speak when a word is needed.
Yes.
And of course, temperance, another word for temperance, of course, is discipline.
Yes.
And we all know that you really can't live any kind of satisfying and fulfilling life mm-hmm. without some discipline on mm-hmm. your needs and your mm-hmm. desires. And so there's a lot of, it shows how Christianity took what it had received and made it its own, but yes. still recognized the profound wisdom
yes.
that was there. Christianity's never been against sort of the learning of the world or the wisdom of the world, even though Paul starts to imply that, but that's not how that text was understood.
No. And that there are certain practices that we can engage in that help us reach that to which we are called. If we're called to holiness by God who's made us in his image, that we're called with the grace of God to restore that image. And one thing I found is that among all kinds of Christians, both Catholic, Orthodox, of course, who've always been attuned to these thinkers, but now Protestant thinkers. Scott McKnight has recently been here at Pepperdine, and if you look at the bibliography of his book, The Jesus Creed, he has many of the church fathers in there. Do you see something like a shift in the contemporary church? Mark Knoll and a colleague have recently published a book, Is the Reformation Over? You have been involved in religious dialogue, or rather intra-religious dialogue, ecumenical dialogue with disciples of Christ, with evangelicals. You yourself were Lutheran for much of your life, you're an ordained Lutheran pastor and now are Catholic. Is there a sense in which, I guess there's two questions here, the Reformation might very well be nearing its end? And secondly, is the time ripe for a recovery of the wisdom that these thinkers have to offer to anyone in the church?
Well, I can speak first personally. Most of my graduate students at the University of Virginia who come to study the early Christian writers, the church fathers, these days come from evangelical schools
yes.
because they realize the importance that these early Christian thinkers gave to the scriptures. But I think the way to answer the question is simply to say this. It's always been assumed since the Reformation that all the Christian communions share the Bible. We didn't agree on how to interpret it, but we all share the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
What I think has happened in the latter 20th century and now is happening in the 21st century is we're beginning to realize that we also share the first 500 or 600 years, and that's an inheritance which is not the property of the Orthodox, the Eastern Orthodox, or the Roman Catholics, or in some cases of the Anglicans or the Episcopalians, but this is an inheritance that we all receive and that we all can draw from it. And so that's the reason why evangelicals are interested in reading these works, which they find are as applicable to their forms of Christianity as it is to Roman Catholic or Orthodox.
Yes.
And I think the same thing is happening with the Middle Ages. There's been an enormous interest in the writings of Thomas Aquinas, who lived in the 13th century, who was always thought as a Roman Catholic thinker. But the number of Protestant and evangelical writers now who turn to Thomas, for one reason, because of his development of natural law as a
yes.
very important way of understanding universal moral responsibilities. So I think that this is inevitable once one begins to think about what it is one is to be in the future, where are you going to go for resources, and many evangelicals have discovered the Church Fathers,
an inexhaustible
resource.
Do you think, I mean, if it's a resource that brings Christians of different stripes, different traditions together, might it also be a resource that can bring the unfortunate left-right divisions that occur in the church? In the Catholic Church, one can see this. Cardinal Bernardine had hoped, while he was alive, to bring a kind of vision of common ground that all of us share. We mentioned here the Bible. You're mentioning the patrimony of the early centuries. What's your sense of that split right now, if there is one? And is there something that the fathers can teach us, or the mothers of the church can teach us, about how that split might be healed or seen in perspective?
Well, the first thing is because their political and social issues were different than ours. When we go back to them, we can't easily transpose our divisions onto their writings. And so simply by reading their writings, we find points of commonality from people on different sides of the issue. The second thing is that for a good part of the early years, Christianity had no political power. And so therefore, the early formative thinking about Christianity understood the church basically as an alternative and an alternate society to the larger society. This is very different from Islam. The Islam begins as a political community from the beginning. Muhammad was the head of a political community, and he was also head of military operations. Christianity doesn't really face that until about 300, 400 years into its history. So one of the things the early church, I think, helps us to see is that there's a sense in which our primary responsibility is to form and develop the interior life of the church, and that the witness of the church to the society is because it provides a model of a different kind of community. And I think that would be my, at least that's the way in which I have begun to try to respond to this, to say that we're at a time where perhaps it's more important that we attend to our interior life and let that be the witness to the world. In other words, the way the church best serves society is to be itself, not to put itself at the service of some political end.
One end to the other,
That's the way I would put it. And I think in that regard, and of course, Augustine, St. Augustine, wrote his major work called The City of God. The title of that refers primarily to the community of those who believe in God, the city of God, and he contrasts that with the earthly city, which is basically the Roman Empire in his day. So he is interested finally in the form that this community's life takes and does not want it to be identified with any particular political community. We've got to remember, Christianity has no stake in any particular form of government. Most of our history, we've thought that kings and queens was the best way to do things. And so there is no way in which on Christian grounds one can say, you must take this view on a political matter.
But it's a different world now, isn't it? We were talking before we met here in the studio about, well, politically, how, for example, Richard Neuhaus has changed over the years. He was one of the leaders against the Vietnam War. Now, as editor of First Things, took a position in support of our war in Iraq. And if someone picks up First Things, it might surprise a viewer or an observer that this same person picks up Commonweal magazine. I'm one who picks up both, reads both, and finds it fruitful to read both. But the question I have, does it become complicated to be someone in, say, Father Newhouse's position when one is as engaged with particular political controversies and the moral controversies, too, that the church is grappling with, too.
I think to talk about the Iraq War does kind of take us a little bit off, I think, the central point here. The reason why many Christian thinkers have felt it imperative in our time to enter into political debates has to do less with questions of war, but has to do more with the moral questions. And so we are at a point in American history where many people feel that there are serious moral questions before the society, that if the laws are not changed or new laws put on the book, we will then begin to create a society in which we tolerate moral evils that are inimical to our deepest convictions as Americans. And, of course, the things that come most to mind are abortion, physician-assisted suicide, stem cell research, because it seems to want to sort of play with the very beginning of life, as though somehow we can control the kind of children that we're going to have. Gay marriage, which undermines sort of a fundamental tenet, not only of our society, but of every human society that we have ever known, that the society is built on the family. And so I think that those people, I've not been one of them because I don't tend to write about these things, but many of my friends do, I think that on these issues they have felt that it does make a difference who gets elected, who is appointed to the Supreme Court, and so have found it imperative to step into the political arena. When everyone does that, it becomes, a gamble because you can't count on the politicians to do the things that you want for the same reasons that you do.
Yes.
And they want to continue to be elected, and they're keeping their eye on many different constituencies. So it's always perilous.
Yes.
And I think maybe we have learned, as we have learned in the past, that if one becomes too consistently political, in the end, then you begin to lose your distinctive religious identity.
Right.
But we do have a very good precedent on this. Of course, it's the anti-slavery movement in the 19th century.
Yes.
And some will say, some would disagree, that the abortion question is, of course, the equivalent in our day of that issue. And that as we look back 100 years from now, we will say, well, how could anybody have defended?
But then this does get complicated, doesn't it? Because I mentioned Noonan and his book, The Church That Can and Cannot Change, and the abolitionists were in the forefront of the anti-slavery movement. The Catholic Church wasn't.
That's true.
And, of course, the church would now find slavery to be an abomination, and it teaches that. But the church developed doctrinally on this very important moral issue. Is there any sense that the church could develop on, say, the issue of homosexuality? Is it possible, is it within the realm of possibility, that this issue might be one of those, like slavery, like usury, I think Noonan talks about, in which the church sees differently in centuries to come, perhaps?
Well, I have to speak here, of course, as a Catholic. The Church has changed on homosexuality in this sense that it is certainly much more accepting of people who say that they are homosexual. And there are certainly many places where people who say that they're homosexual will find support within the Catholic Church in terms of their own individual self-understanding. However, I don't think that the Church will ever be able to change on the fundamental point as to whether homosexuality is a form of sexual practice that the scriptures explicitly, at several points, forbid.
You talk about Paul's letters?
Paul's in Romans 1, and then there are some sort of smaller passages elsewhere. And, of course, Thomas Aquinas believed that the prohibition in Leviticus in the Old Testament still is normative for Christians. So, in other words, the church cannot explicitly ignore or reject things that are said in the primary books of the New Testament, in this case the book of Romans, and do something which is contrary to that. Mm-hmm. If you do that, in effect, you then say that you no longer are apostolic, and I don't see how Christianity can ever do that. It also has to do not just with explicit biblical texts. It has to do with the nature of sexuality. Mm-hmm. What is the purpose of sexuality? And clearly, it doesn't take much imagination to realize that the purpose of sexuality fundamentally is to bring children into the world. So homosexuality cannot ever be discussed except in relationship to marriage and the purpose of marriage. Now, if once you raise the question of marriage, then Augustine becomes very helpful, because Augustine understands that marriage is about having children, point one, but it also creates a social bond between two people that then becomes a foundation of society. So the difficulty with the homosexual issue is that as things have developed in the last 20 years, those who lead among the homosexual, as they call it, movement, they do not simply want to be accepted. They want their understanding to be imposed on the society as a whole, mm-hmm. which means then to change our very understanding of marriage. So it's not a matter of just simply citing a biblical text, but it's a matter of how sexual behavior fits in with the whole understanding of sexuality, yes. and of marriage and of children, yes. and then society as a whole. And I don't see how the Catholic Church can ever really develop beyond that.
But thank God that they are reaching out in this pastoral way. We could go down Pacific Coast Highway and see that kind of thing in St. Monica's Church in Santa Monica, named after Augustine's mother. But let's turn from the church for a moment to the university. You've taught at two church-related schools, Fordham, Notre Dame, and you're now at a secular institution, Virginia. You're here visiting Pepperdine, which is a Christian institution long affiliated with the Churches of Christ. My question is, might your study of the fathers of the church have to offer the contemporary secular university scene and a church-related place like Pepperdine? What would they have to teach? Well, it's teachers. I'm a professor who's going to be teaching confessions in a few minutes. Yesterday in your wonderful lecture, you pointed to the need to read critically, but yet Augustine also talks about the need to read lovingly. We read with faith. When I teach scripture, I read it with faith, but yet I also want to use my reason. The whole relationship between faith and reason that a church-related school tries to take so seriously. You founded an institute at Virginia, the St. Anselm Institute, and perhaps you could speak about that and what you're trying to do at Virginia and what counsel you might have for a school like Pepperdine.
Well, I think what the Christian tradition provides intellectually is depth and perspective. That is, if in the modern university today, in the humanities, which is where I inhabit, not in the sciences, almost everything that is done begins with the Enlightenment at the end of the 18th century. And so the canon of writers that one reads unless they happen to be in Paul Contino's Great Books course here at Pepperdine and others around the country, basically are those of the 19th and 20th century. And, of course, this is a string of brilliant philosophers and theologians and literary people. What that period lacks, of course, is rootedness in a living religious tradition, because a lot of the intellectual work was trying to break free of that tradition. And in the West, people have been thinking about many of these issues for centuries. And some of the greatest thinkers are the ones we've been talking about who are Christian. So it brings depth. Also, if one reads the Christian writers, you almost inevitably have to read the ancient Greeks and the Romans, because they were the people who formed them. Mm-hmm. So it then roots you once again in Plato and Aristotle and gives you a living tradition that ties you back to them. But I can put it perhaps best by quoting Pope Benedict XVI. Last fall, as we know, he made this speech in Regensburg, which caused quite a furor. But most of the furor came from the first paragraph, and very few people read the remainder of the speech. It actually was a defense by the Pope, the head of the Roman Catholic Church, a priest, of the wisdom of ancient Greece. And his argument went this way. He said, what has been characteristic of modern thought is that it has thought that we can only reason about the things that we can see, what is empirically presented to us. But the ancient Greeks reasoned about the soul, about the virtue, the life of virtue, how one was to live morally, what was the good, the highest good that one can see, about God, yes, about how the world came into being. Yes. And so his point is that modern reason is actually exceedingly narrow, yes, and fixated on certain questions. And the problem, and the reason that Islam came into that, he was saying, can we not have reasonable arguments about what kind of a God do we believe in? Do we believe in a God who promotes war? Or do we believe in another kind of God? But with the modern understanding of reason, discussion of God then is not a reasonable conversation. That's just a matter of feelings, yes, you know, a sentiment or tradition or custom. And he says, no, well, if we follow the Greeks, we realize you can argue about those things, reasonable people, and so that reason plays a role in spiritual matters. Yes. Well, you're getting that from the Pope. And the Pope, of course, is the representative of this long tradition of Christian thought. Mm-hmm. I'd say that adds depth to the discussion.
It does.
And much of what goes on in the modern university, as brilliant as it is, as learned as it is, often lacks depth and a dimension that relates it to what humans care about most deeply. Mm-hmm. I was president of the American Academy of Religion. I don't know if you've read this, my presidential address. It's called Who Will Speak for the Religious Traditions? And the point of it was is that the study of religion in the university has become a study of the phenomenon of religion, how it is practiced, what it teaches, and so forth. Yes. And no one speaks for, that is, speaks identifying with traditions.
Yes.
And it seems to me that that's what's missing in the modern university, is people who are willing to say, well, I speak out of this tradition, which is as much tradition of argument and debate as what is going on in non-religious circles, and has every reason and right to be part of the discussion, even though it traces itself back to an original revelation.
That's beautifully put. I think of the early discussions in the early church about, well, the two key doctrinal issues, the incarnation and the Trinity. And I I wanted to ask you just one final question. Czeslaw Milosz has a wonderful poem. I wish I committed it to memory, but where he thinks of Constantine weighing in the Nicene, the council, where they're trying to determine the nature of the Trinity. And as you point out, during these long centuries of conversations, it's not an edifying spectacle, I think you say, and it takes a long time for people to come to an awareness. Milosz is commenting on the irony of Constantine weighing in on this, not a figure that Milosz admires very much, but yet who weighs in on the right side of the issue, seeing the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit as equal. And toward the end of your book, in the chapter The Knowledge of Sensuous Intelligence, you talk about Dante and Paradiso and that beautiful scene at the end of the Paradiso. And you say, with God, this is on page 293, with God, irony is blasphemy. Only when we turn our deepest self to God can we enter the mystery of God's life and penetrate the truth of things. I guess my question is, does God have a sense of humor? Is it possible to agree with our Yiddish, our Jewish brothers and sisters, older brothers and sisters, as John Paul II called them? There's an old Yiddish saw that says, how do you make God laugh? Tell him your plans. you know, here's Chalcedon 451. We think we've got this figured out. But no, it takes another 100, 200, 300 years until Maximus comes along and helps to sort things out still more. Whether it be doctrinal conversations that take centuries and sometimes involve terrible quarrels, or whether it just involves an ordinary human life, does God have a sense of humor?
Well, when you read that passage, I realized that there was an ambiguity in my expression. With God, irony is blasphemy. With respect to God,
yes,
irony is blasphemy is what I meant. In other words, it in our relation to God, irony is not a sentiment that is appropriate on our part. Mm-hmm. So I was talking about something quite different
from that,
you see.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just in the same way, you don't use irony before someone, aged, respectful person.
You wouldn't use irony when you're taking your wedding vows. I mean, this is not the time for this.
Okay. Now, frankly, you told me this story, this Yiddish joke about does God laugh or tell him your plans? Yeah. I can't do any better than that. In other words, I think that, I mean, Augustine said as an old man, he had started to read again the books of the kings, which are basically the kings of the history of Israel. And what he discovered is that all their best laid plans never worked out as they anticipated. And so in that sense, Augustine was saying precisely what this Yiddish proverb said. And of course, you don't have to go back and read the books of the kings of ancient Israel. All you've got to do is read the morning newspaper over the last 10, 20, 30, 40 years and realize how quickly our best laid plans unravel in ways we couldn't possibly admit. So I think, as I say, it maybe be better to end letting somebody else have the last word.
That's right. Well, on that word, a good word indeed, thank you, Robert Lewis Wilkin, for being here at Pepperdine University, and we hope you return.